If you're tired of trying to figure out your own training as a boulderer, we have a program that's just for you. If you're not really quite ready to work with a coach one-on-one yet, we have a training program that is online. It's a subscription program called our Bouldering Training Program. There are three levels to choose from depending on your experience with training. You get immediate access to all of the training days on all of the levels. It's available on your mobile device. It's a clean layout that was developed specifically for training beta with clear instructions for each exercise, and you can track your progress in your online logbook. You also get one-on-one time with your coach, Matt Pincus, in office hours every month, so you can ask any questions you have. So what will your days look like in this program? Matt clearly lays out which drills to do, how to warm up, what to focus on, whether that's projecting, doing circuits, doing limit bouldering. You'll also have other supplemental exercises that involve core work, finger strength, and full body strength work. If you're interested in this program, and hundreds of people have gone through it and had great success, you can find it at trainingbeta.com/bouldering35. And the 35 is because we're giving you as podcast listeners 35% off the normal subscription rate. You can find it again at trainingbeta.com/bouldering35. And if you have any questions about this, just email me at info@trainingbeta.com. This is the Training Beta Podcast, and I'm your host, Neely Quinn. Thanks for joining me for another episode all about rock climbing. And just first things first, I know that my voice sounds weird. I am sick, but I wanted to get this episode out very badly. So I'm just going to do it anyway, and I hope you can bear with my voice for just a little bit. So my guest today is Dr. Jennifer Dragonette, who is a psychologist who partially specializes in what's called DBT, which is dialectical behavioral therapy. And the reason I wanted to have her on is because she's also a rock climber, and DBT can be incredibly useful as rock climbers. So today I'm going to get really personal with you, because in the past I've been sort of ashamed of my mental health history and haven't wanted to share because it just feels too personal. But talking to Dr. Jen, I got very personal, and you're going to hear things that I've never said before on this podcast. So I have struggled with major depression and major anxiety for a long time. My first depression was when I was 9, and I've had like 5 through my life. In 2017, finally, in my most recent one, my most recent major depressive episode, where I was not functional, I couldn't work, I couldn't be social, I couldn't eat, I couldn't, all I did was cry, basically, for weeks, and have panic attacks. And so my husband was like, all right, this cannot keep going. And he found this program that was a group therapy program in Boulder at the hospital, where it was around five people in the group, and then two instructors. And the two instructors were experts on DBT, the dialectical behavioral therapy that we're going to talk about today. And through this program, I found myself transforming. And finally, even though I had been through many, many years of therapy before this, I finally was able to have tools to use in my everyday life. And I think I'm just like a very academic person, meaning I liked school, right? And I like doing assignments. And so DBT was really helpful, because every day I had to go home and like keep track of my behaviors and use very specific skills that they taught me to get through mental anguish and emotional dysregulation and interpersonal issues with my family or my husband or my friends or whatever. And so all of these very structural, intuitive, detailed tools, and then even some worksheets to help you process things more easily by using these tools were they sort of became a part of who I am now. And I am so much less anxious and less depressed and more functional and happier now than I have ever been partly because of DBT, like a lot because of DBT. So we're not just going to talk about DBT in general. We're going to talk about how it can be used in climbing, because I definitely, once I became more functional, like I definitely put DBT in all areas of my life. And so we're going to talk about things like mindfulness, which I know you've heard that word, but we're going to talk about some very specific ways that we can put mindfulness into our climbing. And by paying attention non-judgmentally to ourselves and observing what's happening. And we're going to be talking about things like when we get distressed when we're climbing, when we are not having a good time, when we get angry, when we get shameful, what our values are in climbing, because I found that extremely useful going through DBT too, is like really understanding what my values are and what's important to me in my life, but also in climbing. Like, is it that I want to have fun? Is it that I want to learn? Is it that I want to get to the top? Like, these things come from our basic value system. And so she's going to talk a lot about that too. We also will go through just some general tools. And then my favorite tool is Deer Man. And Deer Man sounds funny, but it's this super useful tool for communicating with people really effectively. And this whole time, Dr. Jen does an amazing job of showing you how to use these tools and kind of embodying them in a way that makes it really obvious how you can apply them even today in your next climbing session. So I've talked a lot and I'll stop talking now. Obviously, I'm really excited about this, but I'm going to let Dr. Jen do more of the talking now. And this is, again, Dr. Jennifer Dragonette, and I'll talk to you on the other side.
All right. Okay. Take three. Welcome to the show, Dr. Jen. Thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks, Neely. I'm really excited to be here with you.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this one too. It means a lot to me to be talking about this topic. And so I'm excited to jump in. So for anybody who doesn't know who you are, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Yeah, I'm a licensed psychologist. I live out in California, and I've been in the mental health field for about 20 years. Some of my specialties are anxiety and trauma, working with people with depression, codependency, people-pleasing behaviors, perfectionism, things like that. And I've been climbing for about 2 years, so I'm a newer climber, and I've just been so fascinated by the overlap between climbing and mental approach. I think there's so much that we can bring to the sport of climbing by, you know, really examining our thoughts and what we're bringing to the rock and the wall. So it's a really interesting overlap. And one of the reasons I'm so excited to be here with you today is, you know, my work as a psychologist doesn't specifically focus on climbing. It's kind of a combination of my two passions. So professionally, I have a private practice where I see individuals and couples, and I really love that work. I love helping people improve their relationships. And I think that's something that actually comes into play when we're climbing as well. And I also do a lot of teaching. And so I work for a mental health company called Newport Healthcare. For several years, I was the executive director there, and I opened several residential facilities for teenagers and young adults. And then about a year and a half ago, I realized that I really wanted to have more time and space to be able to pursue my own passions, and that teaching and supervising was one of those things. And so I made a lot of space to be able to teach things like DBT, which is what we're going to talk about today, and to move into my own practice. So it was a really interesting time for me to be able to create more spaciousness and more focus on the things that really felt, you know, important and passion filled for me too. And climbing has been one of those things that I've been able to spend more time on recently.
Nice. That was a great intro. Good job.
Thank you.
Yeah, really great overview. So basically, you spend your time doing private practice with couples and individuals, and you teach at Newport Healthcare. And do you mostly teach DBT, or are there other things?
There are other things. So DBT is one of the big things that I teach. I teach our therapists nationwide about DBT, and then I do a weekly consultation group around that. So I'm really steeped in DBT. I also teach another type of therapy called acceptance and commitment therapy, which also has a lot of applications to climbing that we could talk about some other time. But and then lots of different modalities. So cognitive behavioral therapy, which is really at the foundation of DBT, is kind of the parent of DBT. And then I get to constantly be learning. It's one of my favorite things about my job there, is that every month I get to train our therapists about something new. And I realized a while ago that learning is one of my passions too. So I get to really deeply learn about a topic and then present it to our clinicians, whether it's trauma or ADHD or relationships or whatever they really need to learn about. So I get to constantly learn and then teach it back and really incorporate that for myself too.
That's interesting hearing you say the words, "I recently discovered that learning is one of my passions," because I also recently discovered that. I mean, I having gone back to school recently to be a life coach, I also understand this like lifelong desire to be expanding our knowledge and learning about especially this kind of stuff. So again, this is like really exciting talk for me. So I think that we've mentioned the DBT enough times where we should start telling people what the heck it means. So what exactly is DBT? Actually, I don't want to go there yet. I want to tell people how we got connected, because it was totally random. So actually, why don't you tell that story? Like, why did you even contact me?
Sure. Yeah. I love this story, and I'm so glad that we were able to share it with everyone. So I will explain what DBT is in a minute. The short version, it stands for dialectical behavior therapy. So it's an approach to therapy that I've practiced and learned about for about 20 years. And because I am someone who loves to learn, when I dive into something, whether it's climbing or yoga or whatever psychology topic I'm into, I really love to immerse myself in it. And so I love your podcast. I was listening to all sorts of back episodes of your podcast, and I came across one where you were interviewing Alyssa Neal around body image, and you mentioned that you had been through a DBT program in the past and that it really impacted your life. And I thought, holy cow, I love DBT and I love Neely and this is amazing. And so I literally paused the podcast and went on Training Beta website and looked up your phone number, and I was just going to leave you kind of a nerdy message like, "Hey, you like DBT and I like DBT," and you answered the phone. And I was so stunned. I probably sounded kind of ridiculous, but was just so excited to talk with you about this, and we decided to make this into a podcast, and so here I am.
Yeah. I usually answer my phone, so if people call me, I will probably answer it.
Yeah. I wasn't sure if you wanted people to know that about you or not.
No, people are always stunned. They're like, "Wait, this is Neely?" Yeah. I don't have like an assistant that answers my phone, so it's just me over here and a couple employees. But anyway, yeah, I'm so glad that you reached out. So now I feel like we can start going into dialectical behavioral therapy. And I'm happy to share my story with it, but why don't you just give us the basics of it?
Sure. So dialectical behavior therapy, first of all, dialectical means two things that seem opposite that can be true at the same time. And that's really one of the important underpinnings of DBT, and one of the things that will probably come up a lot today as we talk about it. So DBT was created in the 90s by Dr. Marsha Linehan, and when she created DBT, it was really for a specific population of people who had been harder to reach, people who had self-harming impulses or thoughts about suicide, people who were really harder to treat. And she, the creator of it, has been really open that she was one of those folks and really just didn't have the treatment that she needed. And then as this became part of the psychology world, we realized quickly that this is applicable to all sorts of people and really just humans in general. So DBT has been shown to be effective for depression, for anxiety, for relationship issues. I've used it in the field of addiction for many years. I use it with adolescents. So it's a beautiful approach to therapy. And it's really a combination at its core of cognitive behavioral therapy, which I can explain if you like, and mindfulness, kind of Eastern approaches to therapy. And so the marriage of those two is at the core, which is acceptance and change. It's really a both and approach. You know, I didn't ask for the circumstances in my life, and I'm the only person who can do anything about it. And so that really underlies the whole approach, which is we need validation for our experiences. And we also need to feel empowered to change the things that aren't working for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, by the time I got to DBT, I had done CBT with several, cognitive behavioral therapy with several therapists, and it hadn't done anything for me. And that's why it was so poignant when all of a sudden I felt like I was more empowered in my life by using the tools of DBT. Because the difference to me, at least for DBT, is that there are these specific skills that you can learn that include, and at least in my case, because I did a group therapy program, we had an entire workbook of worksheets to like systematically go through our problems and figure them out and figure out like action steps and have validation for our emotions and all those things. And so what that did for me was it helped to alleviate my anxiety. It helped to alleviate my depression. It helped me move forward in my life. And that affected me in every single area of my life, not the least of which has been climbing. And so that's why this has been so much more useful to me, because I've done EMDR. I've done is that what it's called? Rapid eye movement therapy. Mm-hmm. I've done, you name it. I've been in therapy for like 25 years, right? And so this is the only thing that's really ever worked for me. It's incredible.
That's so awesome to hear. And that's amazing that you kept at it, right? Because it's so discouraging to have all of these different types of therapies, and some of them don't work for everybody. And that's why I love, you know, learning and teaching other therapists, because I don't think we can just have one tool in our tool belt. You know, some people are going to respond really well to CBT and some people just aren't. And we need to know other approaches. And what you say about DBT is exactly right, that it's a concrete set of skills and tools that you can take with you and bring into every aspect of your life. It's about mindfulness and emotion regulation and distress tolerance and interpersonal relationships. And we don't come with a set of instructions for those things, but DBT kind of is a set of instructions for those things.
Yeah, it's crazy. All I ever wanted was a set of instructions for how to get out of, you know, suicidal ideation and obsessive compulsive thoughts and, you know, extreme anxiety. I just wanted somebody to tell me how to do it, and this did that. So it's really cool that you can come into climbing with this whole lens of being a really experienced psychologist and having all of these tools under your belt. And I am imagining that your introduction and entrance into climbing has been a much more peaceful one. I'm imagining, you can tell me if I'm right or not, than like a lot of other people who we start when we're really young and we have zero, coping mechanisms and skills to deal with the stress that comes along with climbing. So tell me, how has that been coming into climbing as a psychologist?
It's a really interesting question. And shockingly, it's a both and. You know, there are parts of me that I so wish I had come into climbing when I was a teenager. And, you know, some of the things that I've been doing for years and years, like, you know, I was trained as a yoga teacher many years ago. And so my practice feels really solid. And there are moments when I'm thinking, oh, I'm such a beginner at this. And, you know, I wish I were stronger or better. And I'm going to try to catch myself if I'm about to say but in this podcast, because that's part of DBT, is turning those buts into ands so that it's both. And you're right. You know, there are some aspects of it where, I can catch myself as I'm about to fall into patterns that are not helpful for me. I can catch myself if I'm on the wall and I get panicky and my breathing starts to increase. And I can observe and describe that and say, wow, my breathing is increasing, rather than, oh no, I'm doing something wrong, or I have to come down, or I'm too scared. And a lot of that approach, both from DBT and just trying to walk the walk that I talk with my clients about, is, you know, really taking that step back and not looking from the perspective of being stuck in my thoughts, but pulling back and looking at my thoughts and like, I'm noticing that I'm feeling scared of this climb. Why? Let me look at that rationally. Is there anything to be scared of here? If, you know, I've read The Rock Warrior's Way, and I think that that's there's a lot of DBT in there too. If I've assessed this as safe, then I have to believe that it's safe and I can either go up or I can fall, but nothing bad is going to happen to me. And kind of being able to take that approach has been really helpful. It's been an interesting process. I was lucky that I think I was able to dive into climbing pretty quickly, both from having a yoga background and also having a little bit of that mental training under my belt. And there are times that it's really frustrating and I want to be farther along than I am, or I want to be, you know, physically stronger than I am. And I get caught up in the, you know, how do I train my body to match my level of stoke here? But it's been a fun project, and it just is continually, I think because of that love of learning that you and I both share, there's always something to learn when you're climbing, whether it's about body movements or my own, you know, breathing process or my state of calm on the wall or how I'm communicating with my belay partners or what type of routes I want to take on and what can I learn from that about myself. Being able to take that step back and look with awareness at, you know, why does this kind of hold scare me more than that other kind of hold? And what is it that I'm afraid is going to happen in reality, you know, versus what my mind is telling me I'm afraid is going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Wow, so many skills you just mentioned in there that you're personally using in your own climbing. Mm-hmm. And I know that you said that you haven't worked with very many climbers in your practice. Is that true?
I have a couple I'm working with. They haven't necessarily come to me for help with climbing. We have a fantastic gym in my area that Kevin Jorgensen just opened called Session. It's about a half hour from me. And so I happen to have a few climbers in my practice who climb there, coming to me for other things, anxiety or relationship issues. And climbing comes up from time to time, which is interesting. It comes up in two different ways. Sometimes it's, you know, taking the anxiety that they're feeling in their life, and it's kind of a microcosm. I think, you know, climbing sometimes shows us what our thoughts and feelings are looking like. And sometimes the lessons that we learn from climbing can filter back into our life. Mm-hmm. You know, we're stronger than we think we are, for example. And that's one of those things that I think people often learn up on the wall is, wow, I didn't think I could do that. And I tried hard and I did. So what does that say about the rest of my life? And, you know, maybe there are things that I didn't think I had the capacity for that I could just try. Maybe being courageous, you know, because courage doesn't mean not having fear. Courage means walking along with the fear and doing it anyway. And that's a lot of DBT and what I talk about in therapy anyway is, you know, what are we really afraid of in our life? And what would that bold move look like? And what's a behavior that we could put into place to try that out and test it? Because when we're just avoiding things that we're afraid of, all we're doing is giving ourselves evidence that that thing is meant to be scary. And so we never get to build up the evidence on the other side that maybe it was scary and I did it anyway, or maybe I learned something surprising.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're noticing with your clients that like a lot of these anxieties that they have in climbing are also present in the rest of their lives, and you're mm-hmm. kind of working on all those things. And I'm curious how you think the DBT could be most helpful for climbers in general. I'm sure that as a climber, you've observed things in yourself, but you've probably also observed a lot of things in other people. And that actually, now I'm just imagining you at a crag or at the gym and watching somebody like toss some huge wobbler and being like, this could be easily mitigated with this, mm-hmm. these couple tools. But do you want to talk about some of the main themes that you see that DBT could be helpful with climbers?
Yeah, I would love to. I think first and foremost is mindfulness, and that's really underpinning DBT. That's what essentially differentiates it from CBT in a lot of ways. And what I mean by mindfulness is not meditation or there's a specific mindfulness practice that you have to bring to the wall, but mindfulness is simply moment-to-moment awareness. So paying attention in the present moment, non-judgmentally, with intention. And so noticing what's happening from moment to moment, being in the present rather than in the past or the future. And for most of us humans, we're not in the present most of the time. We're worrying about something or rehearsing it, or we're rehashing something that already happened and like shitting on ourselves, like, oh, I shouldn't have done that, or I should have done this differently. And that is, it's like running into a brick wall when we're in that should space, because it happened. It already happened. So we can have emotions about it. And DBT really believes that emotions are very important. And I say this all the time, that feelings are just information. And that what we can do in this present moment is focus on, okay, so what am I observing? I'm observing that my hands are shaking. I'm observing that my breathing has changed. I'm observing that I'm feeling uncomfortable with this partner, and I'm feeling nervous about talking to them about it. And so I'm about to do a climb that I'm not okay with. And so just really noticing, bringing that present moment awareness in rather than what's going to happen if, or what already happened. So I think that mindfulness, one of the four main components of DBT is mindfulness. And that's one that I would really start with for climbers, because all we have is the present moment. We're there on that wall. We're there at the crag. We're making decisions. Are we safe or not? And if we're not in the present moment, A, we might not be making the best decisions, and B, we might not be enjoying it. And Isn't that kind of why we do this, right? To push ourselves and to enjoy what we're doing and to do hard things. And if we're not in the moment, then we're missing out on this experience that we're working so hard for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In all those things that you just said, we hear about people saying these things, you know, like be in the moment and don't think about like one move at a time and stay in the present. And it's easy to just sort of like gloss over that stuff sometimes. But what DBT does a really good job of is like, I'm looking at your outline here. And under mindfulness, you have how skills, what skills, wise mind. And I think that the helpful part of DBT is it breaks it down into all of these things. Like, okay, you're having an emotion and you're dysregulated. And so what do you do? Like there's specific instructions of what you do. You're not just like, oh, now I need to meditate, you know, like that. Cause that's what we all think of when we think of mindfulness is like meditating every day. Well, that's not gonna, I mean, yes, that can definitely help you as a climber, but in the moment we need these skills, like non-judgmentally observe what's going on, describe it, even if it's just to yourself. And like you wrote down, participate in the moment. And A lot of times I feel like just, you know, because climbing puts us into this space where we're just sort of all over the place and we're kind of panicky. And it's easy to not even be able to describe how you're feeling. And if you just take a moment to do that, even by yourself, like it can just be so helpful. But what are your thoughts on that?
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And you're right. It's overwhelming to say to someone, just be in the moment, just be mindful, you know, just bring your attention in. Like, what does that even mean? And,
and then
we feel like we're doing it wrong. And I can't tell you how many people I've talked to who feel like they do mindfulness wrong. And you know, what I say in that moment is, okay, so you just noticed that you weren't mindful. So you were mindful in that moment. You noticed that you wanted to bring your attention back, and that's it. That's fantastic. That's all we're doing. And so if you are paying attention in that moment enough to notice what you're feeling, you're being mindful. If you're noticing how you're breathing, you're being mindful. If you're noticing your urges, you're being mindful. Like, I have the urge to come down off this wall, or I have the urge to yell take, even though I know I can hang on, or whatever it is. That participating, doing the next best thing. And there's a phrase that we use a lot in DBT. It says, do you want to be right or do you want to be effective? And sometimes, you know, we're right with a capital R. You know, it shouldn't be this way. I should be stronger, or I should be able to climb this. I climbed this yesterday and I should be able to do it today. And you might be right, but is that effective? What's effective is noticing in the moment how we're feeling and what our experience is, because it changes from day to day. And one of the things that I like about the mindfulness approach with DBTs is that it breaks down the states of mind into the reasonable or the rational mind and the emotion mind. And we have both of them, and they're both important. And the reasonable mind is kind of cool, calm, and collected. You know, it's the part of our mind that we need if we're doing our taxes or if we have to do something really detail-oriented. We don't want to get rid of that. And the emotion mind is really important too. It's hot, it's, you know, heated, it's excited about things, or it gets really big when we have big feelings about things, and we need that too. We have times that we want to be 100% in emotion mind. Like, you make it to the top of that climb, you're like, oh my God, I can't believe it. Or you're celebrating something with a friend or with your partner, and that's good too. And there are times when being all in one or the other state of those minds is not the most effective. And so DBT talks about the wise mind, which is where those two overlap. If you picture kind of two overlapping circles and there's a Venn diagram in the middle, that place where you acknowledge both the rational mind and the emotion mind is our wise mind. And that's the part of us that can validate the emotions and say, yes, I get it that you're scared, or I get it that you're angry. And what's the next right step here? What's the thing that's going to be effective and move toward my goals? Is it going to be effective to have a temper tantrum right now? And probably not. And it makes sense that you're mad, right? And that validation piece is really important. Because if we just try to get rid of the emotions and say, stop being mad, don't be scared, that doesn't work, right? And so then we feel bad about having the emotions and we're not doing anything effective. So we have to do that both and, where I understand why I'm feeling this way. And sometimes we understand why we're feeling because of history, because we have a history of trauma, or we have an innate, more high level of sensitivity than some other people do. And we have to validate that too. And that's a piece of that wise mind approach.
I'm going to put you on the spot here, and all those examples that you just gave are really great. Can you think of a specific example of a situation where the wise mind would come into play and what both of those sides would be of it?
Mm-hmm. In terms of climbing specifically?
Yeah, with climbing.
Yeah. I can think of one that it just happened to me. And so I was down in Joshua Tree over the winter holidays for a week of climbing, and I was so excited to be there. And my husband and I had planned this trip for a while, and we'd plotted out all the walls we wanted to climb on. And we got down there and had a kind of a warm-up day, and it was really exciting. And then on the second day, I got really sick. I got a stomach virus, and I was out for like 3 days, and I was so bummed, right? And all the emotion mind was coming in, and I knew I was going to be on this podcast, and I was like, this was my time to prepare and get excited and be climbing. And so all of those, you know, emotions came in, and the kind of self-doubt and the frustration, excuse me. And so when I finally was feeling better and got back out on the rock, I wasn't as strong, right? I had been out for a couple of days and, you know, just not moving much. And so I picked a climb that was too hard for me that day. And I was scared. And I don't often get scared on the wall, which I don't say that as like, oh, I don't get scared, but I use these skills a lot. And so I really look at, you know, what's the risk? And so it surprised me to be there and to be scared. And I really was kind of having that fight or flight response, and my body was reacting, and I was, you know, over gripping and shaking and like, what is this? And I felt like I wasn't myself. And in that moment, I had to walk through this exact process. And I was like, okay, I'm in emotion mind right now. I'm feeling scared. I'm feeling frustrated. I'm feeling angry. I'm feeling resentful about, you know, my body let me down by getting sick when I wanted to be active. And, you know, I was really trying to shoot down that side. I'm like, don't be scared. Don't be angry, right? It's exactly what I was just saying. So even being a psychologist for this long, I'm still human and this still happens to me. And so I had to, in that moment, recognize, okay, it makes sense that I'm feeling all these things. This is disappointing. This isn't how I wanted this trip to go. And what's effective here in this moment? Is it effective for me to be clinging to this rock, terrified? Or do I need to take a breath and come down and reassess and maybe try a different route that's where I am today and be realistic with myself and know that I can always come back? This isn't the last time I'll be climbing on this rock. And make space for the frustration and the sadness around that.
Mm-hmm. And so how did that work for you?
Better. Yeah. You know, once I got to that point, but it took a while. And I was really heartbroken about it. I was so excited to be there. And I, you know, I felt like my skills were stronger than the last time I was there. And I wanted to kind of prove some things to myself. I wanted to be right. You know, and I had to do that question for myself. Do I want to be right or do I want to be effective? Because if I keep going this way, maybe I'll get an injury. You know, maybe I'll get so frustrated that I'll, you know, lose some passion for this sport, or I won't want to come back, and that's not what I want. So I had to really look at what's the wise mind approach here, where I can validate how I'm feeling and also make a reasonable decision that's in keeping with my goals and my values.
Right. And that's kind of what I was going to say too. It seems like one of your values, which is for all, a lot of us too, is like having a good time. And it seems like if you had continued down the path you were on, you wouldn't have had a good time.
Exactly. And I wasn't having a good time, but I was kind of forcing it. And we do that. And then it kind of, why, you know, what are we actually getting out of that experience? Is that effective? You know, is that going to leave me at the end of the day grateful that I had this experience? And am I going to learn anything other than kind of self-flagellating and thinking, oh, I shouldn't have done that, and getting stuck in those shoulds?
Yeah. So in my memory of my experience with DBT, and what I had done was, I think it was a 8-week group therapy where it was an outpatient where I would go for 3 hours, 3 days a week, and sit with a group of around 5 people and 2 instructors. And we would go through, we had a giant binder, and the binder was separated into sort of chapters, and it was, you can tell me, mindfulness, emotion regulation, distress tolerance, interpersonal effectiveness. Are there others? I can't remember.
That's it. Yeah. The only other one is for adolescents. We add in one called walking the middle path, which is for families, but for adults, those are the 4.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So in distress tolerance, there's one, radical acceptance, which you have in your outline. And that comes to mind here for this particular situation. And radical acceptance is something that I think is super important for me, because I feel like there's a difference between acceptance and agreeing with something, or like condoning something, or what's the word? Approving. There's a difference between accepting something and approving of something. And so radical acceptance seems like exactly what you did in that situation. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And good memory for remembering all 4 of those modules. It does sound like DBT really was so helpful. We don't like the word acceptance as humans, because we do think it connotes approval, you know, that I like this situation. And the way that I think about radical, and I like that term radical, right? Because we have to fully accept what is. And that's all that it means. It means accepting reality as it is without trying to bargain with it or make it different than it is. We can't change anything unless we've accepted what is. Mm-hmm. And so examples sometimes that I give to my clients is, you know, imagine you came home and someone had painted your bedroom your least favorite color while you were gone. And if you sat there and you were like, no, they didn't, this was the same it was always, you know, nothing changed, then you're living in this room that you hate. And so you have to accept, like, wow, I don't know how this happened, but someone painted my room this horrible color. Now what do I want to do about it? Mm-hmm. So it's acceptance and change. And that's, again, that underpinning of DBT, where it's a both and. And with radical acceptance, one of the things that I talk about a lot is pain. You know, we have pain in our lives, all of us as humans, and pain can look like a breakup. It can look like a disappointing outing in Joshua Tree. It can look like losing a job or falling out of love with your job, or, you know, systemic racism or a pandemic. Like, there are painful things that happen in life. And what we often do is we don't want to feel that pain. And that makes sense as humans. We want to avoid pain whenever possible. And we have this sense sometimes that we can't tolerate it. And so I think that's why we try to avoid it. It's like, oh, I would self-destruct, or I would crumble if I truly felt the depths of this pain. And so what we do instead is we bring in all this stuff to distract away from the pain and to avoid the pain, which works in the short term, but it doesn't work in the long term. And so it's often like we create this cloud of suffering around the pain, but the pain's still there. And so then we've got both the suffering, which could look like, I don't know, turning to drugs or alcohol instead of feeling the pain, or avoiding things that we really like. Exactly. Like doom scrolling, having toxic relationships, right? You know, there's a lot of things that we do that are very distracting for us. And so then if we do want to feel what we feel, we have to get through the suffering and the pain. So radical acceptance is, what if I just accept the pain? What if I just accept that I can't climb this climb today? My body's not up for it today. What do I want to do instead? I can keep you know, fighting with this rock all day long and not accepting that my body is just weaker than it was 5 days ago, or I can accept that and be like, bummer, right? That's not what I wanted. And can I go find a different wall, or do I want to go get a pizza, or, you know, just take it easy and try again tomorrow? That's radical acceptance.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of more instances where radical acceptance comes into play with climbing. And for me, in particular, everybody who listens to this podcast knows that this whole last year I spent either trying or training, or not the whole year, but a lot of it, trying or training for this climb that I was trying. I didn't do it. And there was definitely some radical acceptance happening throughout the process and after the process, because, you know, there's this temptation to be like angry about it and resist the reality, feel shameful, like get into the emotions behind it that you could, you know, shameful, angry, disappointed. And there have been there, like, definitely doing the DBT program has helped me just be able to be like, this is what happened. It's fine. And now I'm going to move forward in this way. Mm-hmm. And it helped me also each day when I would fail or, you know, make backward progress or not reach my day goal on the route, be like, that sucks. And, you know, sometimes I would get upset about it. And then, like, coming back to this radical acceptance of the situation was super helpful. Any thoughts on that or any other situations you can think of that might involve radical acceptance with climbing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great example. And, you know, kind of building on that, I think about the way that we talk to ourselves sometimes, just negative self-talk in general. And I think it often is from a place of non-acceptance. Like, if I beat myself up, then somehow I change the situation or I have control over the situation. Whereas all we can really do is validate. And validating is kind of another word for acceptance. Like, this makes sense. And that's something that I think we can even practice saying to ourselves and to other people. You know, this makes sense. It makes sense that you feel that this way. It makes sense that you tried really hard on this and you didn't get where you wanted to. And, you know, does that mean that you failed? You know, kind of noticing the way that we talk to ourselves and, you know, how is that impacting our, you know, relationship with ourselves or a relationship with the sport that we love. Also, radical acceptance is, this is a hard sport, right? We do it because it's hard, not because we're expecting it to be easy. And sometimes we have to radically accept, like, this is what I set out for. This is what I want this to be. I want this to be a challenge. Maybe not today, right? Maybe today I wanted it to go. But in general, I want this to be a challenge, and kind of step back and accepting, you know, what is the point of this for me? What am I trying to get out of this? Am I trying to learn something, or am I trying to just send every route? Because I could do that, but it might not be the challenge that I set out for. And what's my purpose here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that the validating is so important, because while you can, you know, there's the ideal would be like, oh, this thing happens, I immediately accept it. And that's just not usually how it goes. Like, there are emotions that go along with it. And I think a skill is honestly knowing and being able to identify emotions. I've talked about this before, but there was this Brené Brown podcast episode I listened to, and she was like, most people, we did a survey, and you probably know this, most people can only identify three emotions that they have. And it was like mad, sad, happy, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I think that being able, and that was part of the DBT training too, is like knowing what all of the emotions were, and being able to, like, the difference between envy and jealousy, there's a difference there. And I didn't even know that before. And so being mm-hmm. able to really say, like, this is actually how I feel, and just feel it for a moment and then let it pass through, instead of being like, you feel that way? How dare you feel that? Like, that's a totally unacceptable emotion. And so part of me has also practiced, you know, sometimes even saying it out loud to my partner, this is how mm-hmm. I feel right now. And I just need to sit here with it for a moment. And then usually it'll pass. But yeah, I don't really know where I was going with that, but any thoughts on all that?
Yeah, well, I think it leads us really nicely into emotion regulation, and you know what you're saying is really lovely. Like, this is how I'm feeling right now, and a big piece of, you know, and it is a radical acceptance approach as well, is I'm accepting my emotion as it is. I'm not trying to change my emotion, because we can't, right? I mean, how many times, if we could, we would. If we could not feel scared just by saying, don't feel scared, we would absolutely not choose to feel scared. And so clearly we need to have this emotion for some reason. And being able to practice having emotions, that's really the first step in the emotion regulation approach with DBT, is identifying what we feel in the first place. And it's okay if you need a cheat sheet for that. Sometimes people need to look at one of those how are you feeling charts and point and say, that is the one I'm feeling today, right? I feel bad. I don't know. Give me some words for bad. And then, right. Oh, I feel frustrated, or I feel discouraged, or I feel envious, or whatever it is. But we have feelings for a reason. You know, feelings are information for us, and we've evolved to have emotions. Everything that we are is kind of based on our reaction to our emotions. We take that as information, and then we make decisions based on it. And so if we're trying not to have feelings, or if we're telling ourselves that only this subset of feelings is okay, and this other group of feelings is to be avoided at all costs, then we're stuck in that realm of avoiding pain and trying to not have reality. And so with emotion regulation, a lot of it is accepting that I have these feelings. I love what you're saying about sharing with your partner, this is how I'm feeling. Sometimes saying it out loud takes a little bit of the sting out of it. Mm-hmm. You've probably had this experience with friends too, where if you say, I was having this, you know, fill in the blank negative in quote emotions here, more often than not, your friend is like, oh, me too, right? I've had that feeling too. And it's actually a very bonding experience, but we feel like it's going to be so vulnerable to put that out there, to acknowledge that we have these emotions that we would choose to do away with if we could. And so, you know, part of the emotion regulation is first and foremost noticing what we're feeling, because we're feeling it anyway. And so if we don't notice it, we're just kind of like subject to it. We're kind of on the waves of that emotion without having any agency in the situation. And we're feeling frustrated. And I've had this experience too, where I kind of don't acknowledge how frustrated I am, or how hungry I am, or how tired I am, or whatever it is. And then after the fact, I'm like, oh, that's why I was so cranky, or that's why I was not climbing the way I wanted to be, or that's why I gave up so quickly, or whatever. So part of emotion regulation is protecting that baseline of our emotions. And some of us have bigger emotions than other people do. That's just part of how we're wired. Some people come into the world with big ups and big downs. Some people have experiences in life that give them bigger emotions than other people might seem to have. And I think the emphasis is on seem, because we only see what people show us of themselves. Mm-hmm. But there are ways that we can protect our emotional baseline so that, you know, we're getting enough sleep, we're eating enough food, we're protecting our relationships, so that at least when we show up to climb, we're not showing up with all of that other deficit and vulnerabilities, you know, hanging out there. Then we're just left with, okay, purely, I have these emotions, I have this experience, what do I want to do with this today?
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that we wanted to talk about was a values exercise. And I remember very clearly going through the values section of my DBT group, and how I use that in my life so often right now. And I find myself saying, like, trying to pick out other people's values too, so that I know what's important to them. And I really think this is valuable. So do you want to go through this values exercise?
Sure. Yeah. So values are so important. We need to know what our values are. And that might sound like an odd thing to say, because of course I know what I value, and yet we might not. So there are some exercises that we can do to kind of define our values for ourselves. I'll walk through a couple of them here, and then there are certainly more than this. One way that we can think about our values is to imagine, and this is going to sound morbid, but it's actually not meant to be morbid. Imagine that you were attending your own funeral, or you're listening to someone deliver your eulogy. What would you want them to say about you? What do you hope is remembered about you at the end of your life? How do you, or if you want to kind of take a step back from that kind of end of life scenario, if you were to overhear someone describing you and you were so proud of how they described you, what would be important to you? What are those things that you hope come through about you in your life? So that's one way, is kind of picturing, okay, how do I want to be remembered? What is the impact that I want to be having on the world? Another exercise that I like to do, and your audience can kind of like pause the podcast and go do this and come back if they want to, is just look online for a list of values. If you Google, you know, values list, you'll find so many of them, lists of like 300 values or something. And this is one of my favorite ones to do, both with the therapists I train and with my clients, is look at this big list of values, and they're all good. And that's the great thing about values. You know, pick three at random, like authenticity, family, and connection. Great, beautiful. You know, love, faith, and humanity. Great. So all values are good. And you're looking at this list of values, and it's important to not overthink it, because we innately know what's important to us. So an exercise that I love to do and recommend people do is get a list of values in front of you, set a timer for 2 minutes, and go through and circle all the values that rise to the surface for you, just kind of automatically. And then set another timer for 30 seconds and go through and narrow it down to 10. And then set a timer for 20 seconds and narrow it down to 15 or to 5. And then finally set a 10-second timer and just narrow it down to 3. And it's really interesting when people do that, how much they agree with those values. It's typically kind of clear, you know, that initial thought is like, oh, I don't want to get rid of this one, or I don't want to get rid of this one. And then at the end, it's like, oh no, this is me. These are me. And I actually just did this yesterday in a training I was doing. And I asked people to type into the chat, because it was a Zoom training, what their values are. Every single person had 3 different values. They were all unique to them. They were all beautiful. You can kind of imagine like a set of values, and you're like, oh, I get who this person is at their core, who they really want to be. And so then what do we do with that? It's not just like put it on a necklace and wear it around like, this is my value. It's a guidepost. It's a direction sign. So we can then evaluate for our decisions, are we moving in the direction of our values or not? And certainly not every moment of our life needs to be moving in the direction of our values. And we were talking a minute ago about avoidance and kind of not accepting reality. And typically, if we're moving away from our values, we're often in that avoidance space. So it's often one or the other, where we're either moving toward our values or we're trying to avoid some reality about our life. Mm. And that can really help to bolster us sometimes. I know it does for me. You know, like we said, one of my core values is learning and growth. And so when I'm in a tough situation, if I can remember that, that shifts my mindset. Like, okay, so what am I learning here? How am I growing from this, rather than, you know, how is this really sucking and how is this disappointing and not what I wanted? So sometimes just knowing what our values are can provide kind of that signpost that we're looking for and help in those really tough moments.
Yeah, that all makes a lot of sense. And I'm wondering if you can give us some more examples of those values and like sets of values that somebody might have and how that would show up in their climbing.
Okay. Let me think if I can remember.
I've been putting you on the spot a lot lately.
Totally fine. It's totally fine. Some of the values that I saw people pull up yesterday, one was humility. One was authenticity. One was passion. So I'll just take that as a random set. So let's say your 3 values were authenticity, humility, and passion. And you're projecting a root and you're feeling really stuck, right? And you're beating yourself up on the wall. So you could look at those values and kind of, you know, maybe you don't have the wherewithal to do this up on the wall, and that's fair. You know, and when you come down, kind of stepping back, like, how can I approach this with authenticity? How can I approach this with humility and passion? Is it authentic for me to to keep hopping on this route today if I'm feeling done. You know, is it would be more authentic for me to maybe have a conversation with my climbing partner because I'm realizing there's something about how they're belaying me that's making me nervous. Mm. You know, maybe there's some humility where my ego has been involved and I have to take a step back and reassess, you know, am I a grade too high? You know, is this realistic for me today? And with the, you know, the passion, let's say that was part of your values. Is this fun, right? Am I having a good time? Is this actually something I'm passionate about? Because I think we can climb for so many different reasons. And if passion is one of your values, you know, reminding yourself why you're doing this. Am I doing this because I enjoy it? Even if it's a type two fun, that's okay. At the end of the day, am I glad I did? You know, sometimes people step back and they think I'm climbing in a way that I don't want to be climbing. It's not important to me to be, consistently upgrading my level every 3 weeks, right? Maybe I want to simply enjoy my experience today. Maybe I want to go boulder around at the gym with my kids and have that be what fuels my passion today. That feels more authentic to me. That feels more, in line with my humility that I identified as my value.
Wow. I'm actually really impressed with what you just did there. Clearly you do this a lot because, you know, that's I think a situation that a lot of people could probably relate with. And, you know, just taking the time to think through this and to have those values, like you said, as goal, did you say goalposts?
Yeah. Kind of direction signs.
Yeah. Direction mm-hmm. signs. Mm-hmm. So yeah. The values exercise could be super helpful for people. And then there another thing that you wanted to talk about with emotion regulation was urge surfing. Do you want to mm-hmm. talk about that?
Yeah, I love urge surfing. So urge surfing is basically come back to the idea that we have intense emotions sometimes. And sometimes those intense emotions look like urges. And you know, stepping back from climbing for a minute, those urges could look like I want to numb out by having a drink and that's not that like no one can ever have a drink, but kind of looking at what are our urges to do right now? And is this serving me? Is this in line with what I want to be doing? Again, kind of holding up those values. So underlying the idea behind urge surfing, when we have a big urge or a big emotion, let's say anxiety, because I think that's something that many humans, if not I think all humans actually experience from time to time, those urges and those experiences come up really fast. You know, if you're looking at like a graph, that anxiety pops up quickly. It doesn't just creep in where you're like a little bit nervous and then a little bit more nervous. You're like, oh my God, I'm so anxious, right? And when that happens for us, our mind tricks us into thinking that that anxiety is going to go up and up and up forever. And so we feel like we have to do something about it. Like I need to intervene here and make this go away because I can't tolerate it. And it's really some of that emotion mind we were talking about a minute ago. So urge surfing says, okay, instead of doing that, instead of intervening and avoiding whatever's coming up for you, can we surf this urge? Can we stay with this urge and use our mindfulness skills? Observe the urge, observe the anxiety, notice it, describe it. I mean, sometimes quite literally, I'll have people actually draw out on a graph over time how their anxiety changes if they just watch it, rather than trying to change it, rather than trying to do something about it. It's this real paradox, because sometimes by not intervening and not trying to make the anxiety go down, lo and behold, it goes down. Because a big piece of how anxiety is maintained is by us thinking we can't cope with it. And so if we let ourselves have the experience of coping with it, that starts to provide evidence for us in the future. If all we ever do is try to avoid the anxiety, then we just build up evidence that we can't cope with it, we can't tolerate, and we have to keep avoiding it. So urge surfing is a conscious process of stepping back and, again, not being in the urge or the thoughts, but kind of watching it from an arm's length and noticing, you know, maybe 5-10 minutes later, the anxiety starts to come down and then pops up again and then starts to come down again. What's really very fascinating about urges in particular, let's say someone's trying to quit smoking or something, most of our urges don't last for more than about 20 minutes. And that feels so surprising to people when I tell them that, because that's not what we think. And sometimes because we're avoiding it, it lasts longer. So we avoid it and then it pops up again because feelings are information. It's trying to tell us something. And so then we feel it again for a long time and we avoid it and then it pops up again. And if we let ourselves have the experience of feeling it, you know, grief, anxiety, anger, if we let ourselves feel it, it may not last as long as we think it does. And then we've built up this beautiful piece of evidence that we can come back to next time and say, I know I could cope with that. I know that my body could handle that experience.
Yeah. I think that was one of the biggest things that I learned through DBT, because if I'm being really honest with everyone, and I've never actually talked about this before, the reason that I got super depressed and anxious was because there were some weird things happening with my body. And I was having really weird body sensations. And I won't go into what that is. Actually, one of the times this happened, I was having like zinging all over my body or tingling sensation, which is extremely unnerving, for lack of a better word, like no pun intended.
Yeah.
And so I became extremely on edge and super anxious. And one of the things that I would do would be to research why. And that became this OCD sort of diagnosis, because I had this thing and I had this urge to research what was going on with me and figure it out. And then the sort of assuaging that I would feel would come from feeling like I had done something about it. And one of the things that changed incredibly a lot with DBT was watching that behavior. And that's something they had me do, was like write down the behaviors that I wanted to change and then talk about, like kind of tally how many times they happened, how intense they were on a scale from 1 to 10, et cetera. And I really wanted to change this behavior and not do it anymore. And it happened. I just stopped doing it. And gradually the anxiety of the situation just went away. And then I realized that the tingling and all of it was happening because of the anxiety. So it was this terrible, vicious cycle. And I didn't even know that anxiety could cause zinging feelings in your body. Now I do. And everybody else should know that too. But it was just like resisting the urge to do the thing. Just let it pass and be okay. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah, it's exactly what I'm talking about. And thank you so much for sharing with everybody your experience, because I think that's so powerful. You know, when we have something happening in our body, it feels so believable. You know, like, this must be dangerous. This must be bad for me, right? And so I have to do something to get rid of it. And for OCD, you know, that's often how that works, is then there's this compulsion that temporarily calms that fear. But then you have to do that compulsion in order to calm that fear. And so then you're stuck in that cycle. And meanwhile, your nervous system is reacting to all of this as though you're in danger.
Yes.
And that's a big piece of all of this, is, you know, we don't have perfect control over our autonomic nervous system. And not to get like too psychobabbly about this, but, you know, we've evolved this beautiful system in our body that responds to danger. And, you know, if we're about to get hit by a car, we're going to run without thinking about it. And that's fantastic. And that's kept us alive for a long time. And it also makes us very anxious in our daily life, because the things that worry us now are not being attacked by a pack of lions, which is, you know, what our ancestors were evolving as they developed our nervous system. The things that worry us now are having a tough conversation at work, or not sending the route that we want to send, or the zinging in our body that we're misinterpreting as something really dangerous. And yet our body still responds as though we're in mortal danger, and will do all sorts of weird things to us, like zinging or GI upset, or, you know, feeling really shaky or nervous. And it's very easy to believe that that means something, rather than that's our body just kind of trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah. And I'm going to ask you, after I tell this second story, for another example, how this affects climbers specifically. But I will say that there was another thing that happened recently where I've dealt with, like so many other climbers, I have dealt with body image issues for many, many years. And there's this urge to check, like there's a lot of checking going on with like what my body looks like and how things fit and what I look like mirror checking too. And finally, I just decided that I don't want this behavior anymore. I don't want this taking up any room in my brain, like ever again. I'm so tired of it. So I decided to take away my mirrors. And I know this is a tool that a lot of people use, and I also took away scales. And so the urge was strong in the beginning to like go find my mirror where I had hidden it from myself. I didn't hide it. I just put it in my office. But and then once I could just like be with that urge and let it go away, I don't have the urge anymore. And it's amazing. And I had said, I was like, I feel like if I didn't have these body image issues where I was thinking about my body so often throughout the day, I could be so much more productive in my life. And I am. I am like legitimately way more productive. And I wish I would have done this a long time ago. But part of me doesn't know that I was even ready a long time ago. But it's just another, I think, example of that urge surfing. But do you have any comments on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is amazing. And it's so powerful. I love that you're sharing these stories because I am sure that like thousands of people are sitting there thinking, yep, me too. And I didn't even realize that was a thing. And yeah, you know, how much that's getting in my way. And just the vulnerability of putting that out there is so powerful. So thank you. And what I hear in there too is a lot of awareness. You know, had you not recognized that having the mirrors and having the scales there was so triggering and prompting these urges, it would be really hard to get out of that. So there's a little piece of radical acceptance in there too, right? Like that this is not serving me. This is not effective in this moment. I can fight with this and I can say, but I want my mirrors, or I can radically accept that this isn't working in my life and I have to make a change around it. So mm-hmm. I hear a lot of power in there, Neely. It's yeah. great.
Yeah. And I didn't even know the checking, like I didn't know I was checking until really recently. I didn't even know. So yeah, it is just a matter of being observant, but so I'm curious, though, like when this happens in actual climbing, because while these are sort of, peripheral to that, like how can you see this happening in climbing?
Mm-hmm. So urge surfing, you know, one way I could see this happening in climbing, I was listening to one of your podcasts with Alex Steiger, where she's talking about trying hard and like staying on the wall until you actually fall off rather than like just falling off because you think you're going to fall off, or, you know, asking for tension because you get scared in that moment. And that could be an opportunity to practice urge surfing, you know, that some of your audience could think about is, okay, I'm having this urge to take because I'm scared. What if I don't, you know, what if I just rest or keep moving up the wall anyway, see what happens. You know, I'm feeling like my fingers are gonna give out, so I'm gonna just let go, versus I'm feeling like my fingers are gonna give out and maybe they will, maybe they won't. What if I keep trying? What if I keep going? You know, that maybe I ride out this urge, because part of urge surfing is recognizing that when we intervene and try to change the situation, it's an illusion of control, whether it's anxiety, whether it's, you know, coming off the wall on purpose rather than falling off. You know, as long as you're safe, as long as you've assessed the risk, right? If you know nothing bad is going to happen to you, then maybe practice just staying, right? Keep going, ride that urge out, let your body have the experience of, yeah, maybe I fall, maybe I don't, maybe I actually am stronger than I think I am. Maybe I can take two more moves before I fall off. And I had no clue, and I wouldn't have given myself that opportunity if I had just gone with that urge and tried to kind of control the seemingly uncontrollable situation.
That's so great. I love how you just framed that in that I wouldn't have. That makes total sense, right? That is really an urge to let go or say take. And like working through that is so valuable. It was one of my goals this summer, was to stay on the wall even when I was uncomfortable. And I didn't frame it as an urge, but it totally is. Yeah, that's great. Yeah. I know we've been talking about this one for a long time, but I will say have a lot of clients, nutrition clients, who are over-exercisers, and I'm assuming that you work with people like this too. And there's just a strong urge. I think a lot of climbers are type A people, and we're like really hardworking, driven, disciplined people. And so I don't think it's uncommon at all for climbers to have this impulse to exercise and train like more days a week than is actually even effective at for climbing progression. And so I think that that's another urge. And I've been working on that with some of my clients, like really digging in, asking them, why do you want to exercise right now? Why do you want to train? And is this lining up with your value of like rest and relaxation and progression and, you know, like enjoying your life? And so I think that that's a big one for climbers too.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Do you want to be right or do you want to be effective? You know, is this actually getting you where you want to go?
So the next one in emotion regulation that you wanted to talk about was opposite action. I love this one. Can you describe what opposite action is?
Yeah, I was thinking about opposite action when we were talking about that last one too. So opposite action is such a cool kind of shorthand for how we can assess what we want to do in a given situation. And the hardest piece of opposite action comes at the beginning, which is recognizing that when we have an emotion, and remembering that emotions, you know, feelings are just information. When we have an emotion, it has an action urge associated with it. So if we feel depressed, what that depression wants us to do, if we kind of anthropomorphize depression for a second, depression wants us to stay in bed, right? Isolate, not do anything. If I feel angry, the anger wants me to lash out, you know, hurt somebody, do something violent. And so the first piece of opposite action is, okay, what am I feeling? What does that emotion want me to do? And is that emotion justified? And that's the kind of the crux of the emotion of the opposite action is this emotion justified? So I was rereading the Rock Warrior's Way the other day, and Arno Illner puts it in terms of fear, like, is this a survival fear or an illusory fear? And it's kind of that question. You know, if my anger is justified, like it's really serving me and helpful in this moment, then maybe I do want to figure out something helpful and important to do with this anger. But if it's not justified, right? Or if my anxiety is not justified, which I think is probably the emotion that comes into play the most with climbing. You know, let's say I'm feeling a lot of fear on this wall. And I look back and I say, is this fear justified? Is this a survival fear? Like I'm free soloing and I'm terrified because I could fall and die? Or is this an illusory fear? I'm on a top rope and the worst thing that's going to happen to me is I might, you know, scrape my knees up or be a little embarrassed. Then opposite action says, do the opposite of what that urge is telling you. So fear typically tells us to avoid, like we've been talking about. So if I assess the situation and I say, okay, this fear is not justified, this fear is telling me to avoid, so I need to do the opposite of that fear. And that shorthand can be really helpful for people. Like, okay, what's the opposite of fear? Do the thing, right? Mm-hmm. Approach the thing. Get on the wall. I've fallen off of this route 3 times, and so I want to avoid it, so get back on it. And it's kind of the foundation of exposure therapy, which is a piece of cognitive behavioral therapy, but can be really helpful for things like fear of falling, you know, fear of you know, failure, is incrementally do the thing that scares you. As long as it's safe, as long as you've assessed that it's not justified, then doing that thing allows your body, allows your mind, allows your nervous system to learn and really integrate that's not a justified fear, to start to have more of that automatic, like, maybe I can do this thing. But sometimes we have to do literally the opposite of the thing that our body is telling us, because that action urge is going to just keep us stuck in that feeling.
Yeah. And like you said, it's like with exposure therapy, you don't necessarily need to, and I'm assuming you agree with me. I mean, there are entire courses on how to approach your fear of falling. It's not like because you're afraid of falling from this very top spot where while you're clipping, you know, you don't have to do that thing. You can fall from a foot above your bolt or at your bolt and start there. But yeah, I love that. And I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about the other emotions. So like shame, anger, sadness, things like that. What are those opposite actions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for something like anger, you know, if we're feeling like, let's just take it for climbing. You know, we've all seen people who get really angry if they don't do a route and they kind of yell or scream or kick, right? And so the opposite action of that would be take a break, walk away, do something to self-soothe, you know, do more of a DBT distress tolerance thing. Like maybe you do some paced breathing, or you put your face in a bucket of cold water or something to help that anger dissipate rather than lashing out. For things like sadness or depression, you know, a lot of climbers have depression because we're humans and a lot of humans have depression. And if depression is telling us just stay in today, you know, just get your laptop and watch Netflix in bed for the next 8 hours, the opposite action would be to get up and move your body, to do something behavioral, move your feet in the direction of your values in some way. Maybe you go to the gym and you climb 3 grades below where you typically climb, but you get up and move. So when we're feeling that sadness, that kind of inertia, rather than going along with it, we do the opposite of that, which is movement, which is connection with other people. Because typically depression and sadness makes us really want to isolate and not connect with humans, which is exactly the thing that's going to help us pull out of that depressed moment or that sadness. Mm-hmm. And for shame, which is, you know, really one of my favorite things to talk about, you know, often shame has the same impact. It makes us want to isolate. It makes us want to kind of convince ourselves that we deserve to feel shame. Often there's a lot of shame associated with trauma. And, you know, just as a psychologist out there, you know, if anybody out there is thinking that's me, I have trauma, you're not alone. You don't deserve to feel that shame. You didn't ask for the trauma. And shame will tell us, yeah, you did, right? This is your fault. You shouldn't talk to anybody about this. You should hide this. You should never, ever, you know, divulge that you feel this shame and put up a bunch of armor so that no one can tell. And the opposite action would be maybe start talking about it. Maybe find someone that you trust to acknowledge, I'm feeling really shameful about this. Or, you know, what is it that you would do if you didn't have the shame? I think that's another good question to ask ourselves. Like, if I didn't have this challenging emotion in this moment, what would I do? And if your answer is, well, I would reach out to that friend who's been texting me for weeks, or I would say yes to that person who's been asking me on the date, or I would apply for that job that I don't think I'm going to get, but maybe. And that's the opposite action, is do those things anyway with the shame. It's not that we're trying to get rid of it. We're just bringing it alongside.
It seems like the values exercise would help guide us in that too. Because if we're feeling ashamed, like shame is a really prominent one for me. So it makes me withdraw. It makes me not want to talk to people. It makes me want to honestly sometimes be passive aggressive. And if I can tap into my values, maybe that would help guide what my true self mm-hmm. really wants me to do.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, if one of your core values is connection, then you know, then you can use that as a guidepost to really move you in that direction. And I think it's so important to give ourselves praise for even the tiniest movement. So it doesn't mean that if you're feeling shamed, you need to like go on your podcast and tell all of your audience why you're feeling ashamed. It might mean that you call your best friend and talk about that, or, you know, that you write it down. And just acknowledge it to your own self, you know, that you have some sort of a journal, or that you know, give yourself like a kind day the way you would treat someone who you love, and just, you know, acknowledge that sometimes we need self-compassion and we can only get that from ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we don't have very much time, and this is long as it is, which I could go, and I know that you could, to talk about this for a really long time. And I think it would be really cool to have another episode with you. But I do want to get to a little bit of the interpersonal effectiveness, because this has been life-changing for me, just even having this tool in my back pocket. And it's a funny one. It's called Dear Man. But can you tell us about Dear Man and how it might be used in climbing?
Yes, and I'm smiling because this is my favorite DBT skill, and I'm so glad we have time for this one. I use this every day. It's just
really?
The best. I really do. So, dear man, so interpersonal effectiveness is the module of DBT that's about how do we deal with humans. And this is the one that often is the most life-changing in some ways because we don't come with instructions for this, and yet our relationships are critically important to us. So there are a few skills and tools in the interpersonal effectiveness. Dear Man is the one that I'll focus on for today. And Dear Man stands for describe, express, assert, and reinforce. And that's really the most important part of the Dear Man is the dear. The man part is stay mindful, appear confident, and negotiate if you can. And what this skill is really used for is to ask for something that you want, to set boundaries, to say no, to get something that you want or need. And I love this skill for all humans because so many of us are stuck in that kind of make-suring space, which is a made-up word that I made up. But we're often kind of making sure someone else is feeling okay, or making sure we didn't get misunderstood, or, you know, just want to make sure that I didn't hurt your feelings. And what we're doing when we do that is we're not paying attention to our own needs, and we're not being clear. And so Dear Man is a way of just boiling down our request to someone in a way that's really clear, really concrete, and brief. And I always recommend that when we're doing a Dear Man that we keep each of those elements, the describe, express, assert, and reinforce, very, very short, like one sentence or less. Because I think we've all been in the situation where someone's asking us for something and we're like, yeah, I could do that. And then they go on and on for like 10 more paragraphs. And by the end, we're thinking, well, never mind, I don't want to do that thing anymore. So we want to keep it brief. And the beauty of Dear Man is that every element of it is really factual. It's hard for someone to say, no, that's not true. They can say, no, I don't want to do that for you. But it's hard for them to counter with a challenge to the facts. So what this really looks like is one sentence or less describing the situation that you're reacting to. For example, let's say you have a belay partner who's not paying attention as much as you want them to, and you're scared when you're up there. You're focusing on, is my belayer going to catch me, rather than am I climbing the way I want to be climbing? So describe might be, hey, on that climb just now, I noticed that you weren't watching me, period. So you don't say, this has happened every time we've climbed, this happens 10,000 times, I'm so nervous about this because I watched you do it with other people. You're just saying, here's the situation I'm reacting to today. And express is the next part, and that's how do you feel about it? And this is really important because when we're talking with someone as a human to human, our feelings matter. So I feel scared climbing with you right now, or I feel frustrated, or I feel sad, or whatever it is you're feeling. So I noticed that you weren't watching me while I was climbing, and I feel nervous about that. The A is assert. What do you want? I want to have your eyes on me all the time when you're belaying me. And I want to feel tension on the rope so I know that you've got me. That's it. And then reinforce is, why does that person want to say yes to you? Why is this important to them? So we have to really think it through. And it could be really obvious, like so that we can keep climbing together, or so that we both feel good as climbing partners. It's just a very simple way. So you would just say all of that together. Hey, I noticed that you weren't watching me when I was climbing, and that made me really nervous. And I'd like you to keep more tension and keep your eyes on me so that we can keep climbing together, so I can feel comfortable. So that's it. That's the deer. And then the man comes into play if for some reason that person says, no, I don't want to do that for you, or that doesn't sound reasonable, or if they start to get defensive and counter with, well, you didn't watch me last time, and kind of derail. So the man is just, don't get derailed. Stay mindful, maybe repeat exactly what you just said, or rephrase it, but keep it really short and sweet. The A is important, which is appear confident. And sometimes this is a little bit of a fake it till you make it situation. We have trouble as humans expressing ourselves clearly in this way. And we fall into that make-suring, like, oh, I feel really bad to even bring this up with you, or, you know, I don't want to hurt your feelings. But, and appearing confident is just putting this out there as though you have every right to ask for this. And that's why it's helpful to think about that reinforcer. This person wants to be your partner, right? You have the right to ask for what you want. And maybe they negotiate and come back with something. I don't know what that would be in this situation, but you know, in another situation, well, how about if I do this slightly different thing, but it's very close? And you might say, yeah, that works for me, or no, it doesn't work for me. So you don't have to be rigid. That's the N in the man, is negotiate if it's comfortable for you. And in this situation, there might be no negotiation. It might be like, no, I need you to keep your eyes on me and keep tension, because that's what I will feel comfortable with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I really love listening to people who are super skilled in this, just be so succinct and direct, because, you know, for me, it still is difficult to do this. And I have a lot of making sure other people are feeling okay, and that I'm not offending them, or, you know, because I have requests sometimes. Like, I was just climbing the other day with some friends who I really enjoy and love. And I was having a scared day. And somebody said, do you want me to belay you? And luckily, my husband was able to step in and be like, she's really particular about her belayers, I'll belay her, it's totally fine. But a lot of times I have to have that conversation, you know, myself, and like talk about these things. And it's really uncomfortable. Like, it's really uncomfortable to criticize somebody for how they're doing something. Do you have any, I don't know, reassurances about that?
Yeah, it is uncomfortable. So, I mean, first I'll just validate that you're not making that up. You're not alone. It is uncomfortable. And I think that that's another piece of that feelings or information, where if it's particularly uncomfortable for this person, then maybe that's important information. Maybe that's not a person that you trust as much as you thought you did. Whereas, you know, might be less uncomfortable. Like, you know, if you were talking with your husband, you'd probably be less uncomfortable setting those boundaries. And so that's important information too. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also, you know, that's where it's about this specific situation. It's, you're not really criticizing someone. You're just pointing out, I'm feeling more scared today. That could be the D in the describe. Like, hey, I'm having a scared day. And this is maybe not a day that I'm okay with having a new belay partner. Or mm-hmm. I'm having a scared day, and so I'm noticing that I'm having some nervousness about you belaying me. And here's what I need from you in order to feel comfortable. Are you willing to do that?
Yeah.
And so it's not I think the reassurance that I want to provide is that you're not criticizing someone, especially if you keep it really specific. And anytime you come back to your feelings, that's why I love the express part of Dear Man, is it's not about them. It's about how you're feeling in that moment. Mm-hmm. Your request might not fit onto somebody else. They may not want that much tension. They may not worry about that if somebody's not watching them every second because they trust the gree-gree or whatever it is. But they're not the person delivering the Dear Man. So you have the right, and I won't go into this, but DBT has this whole list of rights, and we have the right to have our thoughts and feelings. And that's so hard sometimes for us to really believe, because we are taught by society that we're supposed to take care of other people's thoughts and feelings first. And ultimately, at the end of the day, we're only responsible for ourselves, and so are they. And so if you say something that's clear and kind and concise, and they take it as criticism, that really says a whole lot more about where they are than it says about you. All you can do is take care of yourself and be really clear about what you need.
So if we can, I would love to go over just like one or two more scenarios really quickly, because there are a lot of, especially with sport climbing, with bouldering, there are some things, but I feel like your life is in your partner's hands kind of more often when you're on a rope. And so these conversations can be really critical, and I feel like people don't have them because they don't know what to say. So mm-hmm. one of these situations might be if you're working on a route, you've fallen and you got a hard catch, and you're scared to then try the hard moves again because you don't want another hard catch. What would you do in that? Like, how would the conversation go?
Mm-hmm. Or the DM? I think you just said it, right? So the description is, I just fell and I got a hard catch, and I'm feeling really scared about trying it again. That's exactly what you just said. And then the A is, what do you want in that situation? So what would you want in that situation?
I would probably say, I would probably request and say, could you give me a little more slack, or could you jump?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it. And then the R, the reinforce, is I'll feel a whole lot more comfortable that way. And I think we'll be able to keep climbing today if I do that.
Yeah. And I think there is the tone too, because a lot of, you know, you could say, because I would feel a lot more comfortable that way, or like, mm-hmm. I would really feel a lot more comfortable. You know,
exactly.
I think that plays a part in it too, like the nervousness of not knowing if you're going to be able to be authentically in that kind space when you're having these conversations.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And I think that's the appear confident piece. And sometimes it really is an appearance of confidence rather than a reality of confidence. Yeah. And it's okay. I think part of the beauty of a dear man is kind of taking it out of the request and making it more an assertion.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was a really hard catch. I'm feeling scared about trying again. I'd like to do another try on this one, and I'd like you to give me a softer catch this time so that I can feel more comfortable.
Demand, yeah. I mean, not a demand. It's an assertion.
Right. It's just kind of clear, you know, and it's not. And you're right, the tone really matters. Because you could say that in a really, you know, grumpy tone and be very off-putting. It's just that you have the right to ask for that. You have the right to say, hey, we've established that we're doing this partnership together today. Here's what I really need. Mm-hmm. And then it also allows that person to do the same thing for you. You know, what if they want a different kind of a catch, or they don't even want to climb on this route at all? You know, then you open the door to let them tell you what's important to them.
Yeah. The last scenario that I would like to go through is, and this applies to boulders and route climbers, but I have been having a lot of conversations in the last few years about what kinds of cheerleading people like or not. And some people like complete silence, and some people only like certain types of cheerleading. Some people don't like people sitting at the bottom of a climb saying, come on, come on, like that. And sometimes it really gets to people. And I'd like you to tell me what people could say in that situation.
I'm so glad you brought this up, because that is something that I notice a lot. My husband doesn't like cheerleading, right? Mm-hmm. He likes that complete silence. You know, some people love a lot of beta, and some people really don't want any, right? So what this brings up for me is, dear man ultimately is about boundaries. You know, it's about what's comfortable for me, what's not comfortable, what am I reacting to? And we can set a boundary before, during, or after a situation. And that's really empowering to remember sometimes. So sometimes we forget the before part, or even the after, and it's like, oh, I wish I had caught that in the moment. And then we kind of beat ourselves up, like, oh, I was getting all this cheerleading that I didn't want, and I didn't say anything then, and oh, why didn't I do that? And then we're kind of in that shame spiral about it. So we can set up those expectations before. You know, if you're bouldering with a group of people and you know that you want a lot of cheerleading, like that's going to really, really help you, you can ask for that. You can say, hey, I've learned about myself that I am someone who really gets inspired with cheerleading. Could you just kind of track me and yell some encouraging stuff? Because that would mean a lot to me and I would have such a good day. And that's a dear man. Mm. Or you could say, I'm someone who really wants to work out the moves on this route by myself, and it's super important to me that I don't get beta yelled up at me right now, that I just get to work through the strategy of this and figure these moves out on my own. And it, you know, could you just kind of help me in that way? Because that would mean a lot to me. So you can do that ahead of time. And if you don't, and you're up there and you're frustrated and it's not the moment to do it, you can come down and do that afterwards and say, you know what I just realized? And that's one of my favorite phrases for the after the fact is, you know what I just realized is I am someone who prefers less beta, or I am someone who gets distracted by cheerleading. And so next time, as much as I appreciate where you're going with this, I would love to have a little bit more of a silent climb that I can just be in my head.
That's so lovely. That's so perfect. I'm contrasting it with a situation where I was with some friends, one of whom hates cheerleading. One of us accidentally let a good job slip, and he was like, shut up. and it's funny because we know that he hates this and it's a thing, but yeah, I mean, it's really easy to just be in your emotions and not be able to communicate effectively. And I'm not saying that in the moment, right after he fell off, he could have gathered himself like that. But maybe, you know, when he came down, we could have had And he has, you know, but, you know, if it's your first time or something, you could come down and have that conversation after, like you're saying, I just realized.
Exactly. Yeah, that's really funny. Yeah. One of my favorite questions to ask people and myself is, if you could say anything and it wouldn't be wrong, what would you say and who would you say it to? And sometimes that just immediately pops up like, ooh, I know exactly what I would say and exactly who I would say it to. And that's a boundary that you maybe haven't set or that you'd like to set. And sometimes even what comes in your mind would be perfectly fine to say. And we just maybe package it up in a dear man or something. So, you know, that's a question that we can all think about is, if I could say anything and I wouldn't be wrong, what would I say and who would I say it to?
This is a really fun exercise. Now I'm thinking about it. So all of the things that you have talked about today have been, in my mind, fun exercises. Maybe it's type two fun, but I think this has been so incredibly helpful, and I really hope that people take this to heart and maybe start trying out some of these things on their own. And if people are really interested in DBT more, what resources would you tell them about?
There are a lot of great DBT books out there, so I would just start there. You know, Marsha Linehan's written a bunch of books about DBT. You can find all sorts of things online. I'm happy to talk with people about DBT. I have a website that people can check out. It's drjenniferdragonette.com. If people are local to Northern California, I'm working with my local climbing gym, Session in Santa Rosa, to put together a workshop around this kind of stuff. So lots of different options. There are DBT therapists across the country. If you're interested in actually getting into therapy about this, or groups like you've done, Neely, sometimes a group is the best way to do DBT skills training, because you have that shared human experience of, oh my gosh, it's not just me having this experience in my life. Look at all these other people who get tripped up by emotions or wanted to avoid pain. So looking up a DBT program could also be a really nice way to do that.
Yeah. And do you work with people out of state on Zoom or on video call?
I work with people within California over Zoom, although I am establishing more of a coaching practice, so I could talk to people out of state that way too.
Okay. I find you very soothing, and
thank
I think
you.
That a lot of people will probably feel the same. So thank you, Jen. Thank you so much for your expertise. And any last words for us, not to put you on the spot?
Just grateful to be here, and thank you for focusing on this. I think, you know, one of the things we talked about before we started was just how important the mental aspect of climbing is. And for me, that's why I love this sport. It's not just about moving my body. There are a lot of sports we can do that are about just moving your body and working hard. And I think those of us who really love climbing love it because it's also psychologically hard. It asks a lot of us. And so we really have to, we owe it to ourselves to focus on that piece too, you know, just as much as we focus on finger strength and all of those wonderfully important physical aspects of climbing. We can be super strong, and if we're up on the wall, scared out of our minds and not breathing, we're not gonna be able to climb. So I love how much you focus on the mental aspect of climbing, and I'm just grateful to be able to dive into it a little bit more today.
Yeah. Well, again, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Neely.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Dr. Jennifer Dragonette. And you can find her at exactlythat.com. So it's Dr. and then Jennifer and then Dragonette, which is DRAGONETTE.com. I just want to say thank you again to Dr. Jen for being on the show, for, you know, calling me and offering her wisdom to us all. I found it extremely cathartic to be able to talk about these things and to like rehash what I learned and what has now just become sort of a part of who I am. So I do want to mention, and I think I've mentioned it before, but I'm going through a life coaching program right now called IPEC, and I love it. I really, really love it. And coaching is very different from therapy, but it still can very much help people find clarity on where they are emotionally and how they want to behave differently and goals that they want to set. And I think going forward, I'll be graduating in May, and I would love to incorporate more content on the podcast about mental training and just like our mindset in general in climbing. I might do some coaching sessions live on the show. I might just be talking in general and prompting you to answer questions that might help you in your own climbing performance. But so stay tuned for that. I'm just kind of putting it out there into the universe at this point. In other news, like I said in the very beginning of this episode, if you want help with your bouldering training, we do have that online bouldering training subscription. And for you as a podcast listener, we would love to give you 35% off of that. You can learn all about it at trainingbeta.com/bouldering35. And that gets you that 35% off for as long as you're a subscriber, just because we love you as our podcast listeners. So again, thank you so much for listening all the way to the end of this, and I'll talk to you soon.